This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Dating You, Hating You by Christina Lauren. Read by Deacon Lee and Shayna Thibodeau.
Chapter 1. Evie. La Cienega Boulevard is a never-ending hell of snaking concrete, but it's a necessary evil in this town. Running north to south in Los Angeles, it forms an enormous artery, cutting through the 30-mile zone, also known as TMZ, also known as the Studio Zone, historically containing all the early film studios. In its heyday, and before other cities began offering tax credits and big incentives to lure filmmakers into shooting on location, this was where most movies were filmed. It's been the center of hundreds of millions of dollars in movie deals over the decades, but I've never heard anyone in the industry throw out TMZ in casual conversation. Not in the way you're thinking, anyway. Similar to a tourist shuffling around San Francisco and calling it Frisco, anyone referring to the nexus of Hollywood life as such nowadays would reveal herself as an out-of-towner who'd happened upon a detailed Wikipedia page. It's so archaic, in fact, that many of my colleagues don't even realize that's where the gossip site got its name. La Cienega looks like most surface streets here in Hollywood. Rows of shops and restaurants built at odd angles and crammed into every inch of possible space. Palm trees and billboards that shoot for a gray-smudged blue sky. And cars everywhere. To the north is the stuff most Hollywood dreams are made of, where a backdrop of steep hills seems to have erupted straight from the asphalt. Multi-million-dollar homes sit like Tetris blocks on the hillsides, their gleaming windows and gated drives towering above the city. It's one hell of a panorama, if you can afford it. But, like most people here in Los Angeles, I have my feet safely on the ground, and at home my only view is into the apartment across the alley, inhabited by a frequently shirtless Moroccan juggler. There are worse sights, I suppose. Although I hate La Cienega and its never-ending gridlock, the boulevard is as much as the crow flies as you're going to find through L.A. Any local will tell you that driving here is all about timing. Leave at 2 and you can get nearly anywhere in 20 minutes. Leave at 5, like everyone else, and it'll take you an hour to go 5 miles. Thank God I'm usually one of the last ones out of the office. I look up at the sound of a knock and see Daryl, in all her blonde-haired, blue-eyed glory, standing at my door. While I'm the precise amalgamation of my 2 dark-haired, dark-eyed parents, Daryl Hannah Jordan is the picture of her namesake, and looks more like she just washed up on the set of Splash than grew up in San Dimas, 3 houses away from me. "The workday ended over an hour ago," she says. "Just reading this article before I go." My eyes narrow instinctively as I study her. Daryl was in a skirt and sky-high heels just a few hours ago. Now she's wearing a pair of scrubs and has her beach blonde hair pulled back into a ponytail. "We have that party at Mike and Steph's tonight. Please tell me that's your costume." Daryl starts to fidget and becomes increasingly interested in a non-existent spot on the hem of her shirt. And I know I've been had. "No," I gasp. "I'm sorry." She falls dramatically into the chair opposite me. "You dick, you're flaking? I don't want to, but I forgot I promised my uncle I'd come in tonight. Why didn't you remind me this afternoon? You know that's your job in this relationship." I slump back in my chair. Daryl worked her way through college at her uncle's medical spa, and enjoyed the hell out of that employee discount while she was there. She's gorgeous, with tight skin, perfect boobs, and a thigh gap you could watch TV through. But she's also the first to admit that a chunk of that is due to the pioneering efforts of science and her uncle, Dr. Elias Jordan, plastic surgeon. Daryl turns 30 this year, and in addition to her job upstairs in the TV literary department, she's been doing some extra work for him on the side to pay for all her recent fine-tuning. Like most people in this town, she's determined to never grow old. Thankfully, she doesn't have to worry about that anymore because I'm going to kill her. Well, this day has been comically bad. I checked my phone before tossing it into my purse. Remind me why I love you. You love me because I listen to your endless movie trivia, and my passivity complements your need to be in charge all the time. I wish I could argue, but she's made two good points. I grew up obsessed with movies. It's in my blood. My dad was an electrician for Warner Brothers, and my mom did hair and makeup for almost every studio around. By the time I was 8, I'd convinced them to let me ride my bike after school to the neighborhood video rental store. Yes, I am old. And then talked the crusty old manager, Larry, into letting me work there for free rentals. When I was in 11th grade, he finally agreed to start paying me. I've traveled the world, but L.A. has always been, and will always be, my home. It isn't only because my family is here. It's because my heart resides in the grit and chaos and unspoken rules of Hollywood. That's why I became a talent agent. I've never wanted to be in movies, but I've always dreamed of being part of how they were made. And I do always need to be in charge. She's totally got me on that one, too. Fine, I say. But next time I'm set up on a terrible blind date by a client and can't refuse, you're putting on an Evie face and going in my stead. Done, she inspects me with a forced smile. Not to add fuel to the fire, but is your costume in the car, or are you going as a surly but fashionable banker? I open my mouth to tell her exactly what she can do with my costume, but I catch movement through the open doorway over her shoulder. Amelia, I call, and she pokes her head inside. What are you doing tonight? Please, please tell me nothing, Miss Amelia Baker, my favorite person alive. I'm picking Jay up from camp, she says, and spending the rest of the night in my pajamas eating ravioli out of the can. My head drops to my desk. I work in features, representing actors and actresses, and Amelia is the second in command in HR. Because she got a start in adulting earlier than most of us around here, Amelia is also proud mommy to the smartest, handsomest 12-year-old boy in the world. I am verging on desperation. Any chance you could get a sitter? Amelia steps inside and sits on the arm of Daryl's chair. Her hair is cut close to her scalp. As much as I'd like to be able to pull off a style like that myself, it's never going to happen. But on her, it shows off her bright smile, luminous dark skin, and cheekbones for days. On a Friday night? Her tone carries an undercurrent of guffaw. Not a chance. Why? Because Daryl is the worst friend and you're the best friend? Her laugh tells me to give it up, and I groan. You have big plans? With completely unmasked sarcasm, she adds, It's not like I expected you to have a date or something, but, you know, one can hope. I sit up and point dramatically at Daryl. I was supposed to go to a party with that one. It's true, she says guiltily. But I forgot and promised Uncle Elias I'd go through his accounts. Amelia points a mom finger at her. You are not having something else done to your face. Daryl immediately waves this off. We rarely comment on anything Daryl has done. She's a grown-up, and as perfect as we think she already is, she's doing it because she wants to, and, well, it's really none of our business. Still, even I'll admit she's been a bit overzealous lately. Just a little light dusting. Daryl gives a prim flourish of her hands and then turns back to me. Speaking of, I need to get going. I guess I'll head out too. No sense prolonging the inevitable. I move to slip some work files into my bag, but then I remember what I'd been reading. Hey, real quick, did either of you see the article about Brad and Variety? I lower my voice and look out into the empty office. Wait, is he still here? Amelia peeks out and down the hall toward the office of Brad Kingman, vice president of Price and Dickel, head of features and asshole extraordinaire, and returns, shaking her head. Just us and Dudley, I think. I point to my computer screen and the two of them huddle behind me, reading. It wasn't about him, exactly. I point to the article in question. Just a mention of how he was having dinner with Gabe Vestas. Gabe is an A-list movie star who signed with our rival agency, CT Management. And funny thing, everyone knows Brad and Gabe hate each other, although no one really knows why. Daryl straightens, unimpressed. That's it? I thought this was going to be something tawdry and scandalous. I give her a little growl and look back down at the article. I'm not reassured by her certainty that this is meaningless. Suspicion itches at me. Maybe they patched whatever up, Amelia offers. I hum, unconvinced. I don't think that's a thing that happens to Brad unless there's money involved. You go ahead and think on that, Nancy Drew, Amelia says. But Jay is waiting, so I gotta jet. She turns to leave but stops, just shy of the door. And before I forget, a memo ran by my desk today. It'll probably hit your box this week, Evie. Brad is postponing your department's annual retreat, so you can take it off your calendar for now. Postponing? Did it say why? My spidey senses are heightened now. Brad has held our features department retreat in Big Bear the same week every November for as long as anyone can remember. Didn't say, Amelia tells us. All I know is that it's been delayed indefinitely. And I'm sure I won't hear you complain about skipping an entire weekend in the woods with that guy. When you're my age and living alone in an apartment with a common entrance, endless hallways, and tiny buzzers on the doors, you forget that creeping hopelessness you get walking up to a real house. A house with a porch and a craftsman door and a knocker that tells you a little something about the people inside. An iron dragon, a brass rose, maybe a copper gargoyle. I stare at the perfectly tarnished cherub on Steph and Mike's front door and scowl, suddenly feeling a lot less satisfied with my life than I did only a few hours ago. They're 6 years younger than I am, and they're already knocker people, front door people, homeowners. I can't commit to the yearly plan for Netflix and don't even own the car I just parked 2 blocks down the crowded street. I am a terrible adult. I glance at my black robe, at the burgundy and yellow tie, at the wand in my hand, and wonder why I ever agreed to this. I'm 33 years old and at a costume party dressed as a teenage Hermione Granger. Jesus, Evie. Damn you, Daryl. And it takes some bravery, let me tell you, to come here alone dressed like a teenage Hogwarts character. There's this instinctive panic, that Bridget Jones, Tarts and Vickers-induced anxiety, that the door will open and everyone will stare at me with jaws agape and Steph will whisper in empathetic mortification, "Didn't you get the email saying we weren't doing costumes?" At least with Daryl at my side, that outcome would be funny, and we could drink and tease each other about how we ended up here on a Friday night. But alone? Not so much. Here's to hoping the come-as-you-are theme held, because a girl who needs a time-turner to get everything done each day is a perfect alter ego for a single woman working in Hollywood. I lift the knocker with some effort, using both hands. It's surprisingly heavy. When I let it go again, it doesn't make the soft, deep knock I imagine, and instead strikes with a deafening, metallic crack against the wood. The sound reverberates in the tiny brick courtyard, and for a single, terrifying heartbeat, the giant cherub wings wobble on their hinges as if they might crash to the ground. Jumping back, I notice the perfectly normal doorbell on the outside wall. Clean, obvious, and to all appearances, completely functional. So, not a knocker, then. The door flies open, letting out a roar of laughter that, from the way everyone is staring at me, seems to be directed at the racket I've just caused. Steph steps forward, bringing a waft of her Prada perfume with her. With a graceful, manicured hand, she stills what is obviously, in hindsight, a metal door decoration. "Evie's here!" She pulls me into a hug. "You're here!" I like Steph. We used to work together at the Alterman Agency when I was a young, shiny new agent, and she was an intern. She's still there, a full agent now, and to this day she holds the honor of being the colleague, past or present, whom I least frequently wanted to strangle. She's warm, she's accomplished, but once I step inside, I'm reminded again that she is frantically trying to cling to her teenage aesthetic even though she's neck-deep in her 20s. Case in point, her costume. I'm pretty sure she's dressed as Wrecking Ball-era Miley Cyrus in a cropped white tank and a white bikini bottom with boots. Also, I spy a table in the corner with an artful arrangement of Red Bull cans and a selection of fancy vodkas. Ushering me in, she says, too loudly, "That thing is just decorative, you goose. You scared everyone. And oh my God, Hermione, you look amazing. You are so great for coming alone, my brave little Evie." Brave? The sound you heard? The one that sounded a little like tire screeching? That was my confidence coming to a standstill just inside the door. I look around at an assortment of expectant faces wearing polite smiles, waiting for introductions. A friendly-looking redhead dressed as Ariel, with her arms around the waist of a tall, Hispanic Prince Eric. An aloof brunette dressed as a vampire, whispering something to her vampire boyfriend. A few couples across the room who had been engaged in a group convo, but are now staring at where I've just brought singledom into a party clearly meant for pairs. "Everyone, this is Evie / Hermione. Evie, this is everyone." I wave, muttering to Steph out of the side of my mouth in my best Bogart.
"You didn't tell me this was a couples thing."
"It's not, really. It just ended up that way," she chirps, pulling me deeper into the living room. "I promise it'll be great." For a second, when I spot two women dressed as Beyonce and Nicki Minaj snuggling on the couch, I think she might be right. This is an open-minded group, and I am a strong female choosing to embrace her independence and attend a party alone. Nothing to feel out of place about here. But then she steers me past the main cluster of guests and parks me at the Red Bull and vodka table. So that's how it is. "Is Morgan at least here?" I ask hopefully, happy to entertain Steph and her husband Mike's toddler all night if it helps me look even a fraction less awkward. She looks at me with a dramatic little pout. "At the sitters. How's work, by the way?" My shoulders sag, resigned. "It's fine. Tyler, the Broadway actor I signed in March, he isn't here full-time with his wife and kid until the end of November, so I told him I'd check on them. I basically spent the day in a child sensory training and integration seminar where babies play with cooked pasta in giant plastic bins for $700 an hour." There's an understandable beat of silence before Steph leans in closer.
"You didn't."
"I did." And talking about it again, I remember how incredulous I was when we walked in. A group of tiny women in white jeans with their perfectly dressed, smudge-free children staring excitedly at giant bins of cooked noodles. But as the hour went on and I saw Bee's joy over the naughtiness of playing with her food for fun, my cynicism over the ridiculous parenting extravagance lessened, and I started to feel like, yeah, this is pretty awesome. But that is exactly how your brain gets corrupted in this town. $700 an hour to squish noodles in their chubby fists. These kids could have an awesome time playing with macaroni in their bathtub at home for $1.50. You aren't her nanny, Steph reminds me with gentle outrage. No, I know. But I adore Tyler, and his landing the lead in longboard was a huge coup for us both. A coup I sort of needed, and Steph knows it, too. I'm happy to check in on his family, obviously, but yeah, not a nanny. How about you? Things are good? Yeah, Ken's been acting a bit weirder than usual, but... She mimes, tipping a bottle back dramatically, and I laugh. The office cocktail hour with Ken Alterman, my old boss, was always an adventure. Someone catches Steph's eye from across the room, and, despite my pleading headshake, she gives my shoulder a reassuring squeeze and says, "Hold tight, I'll be right back." And then she's gone. You'd think I'd be used to this sort of thing by now, navigating a room full of matched-up people, alone. But somehow it never really gets easier. I pull my phone out of my robe pocket, quickly texting Daryl. "Jerk, I am the only singleton." It was a couples party? I didn't know. Neither did I. I would have faked diarrhea in traffic. Actually, that might have been more pleasant. With a mental groan, I glance covertly at the time before tucking my phone away again. I can stay for 45 minutes, right? That seems like a length that communicates, "I value your friendship and I'm so glad I came," and, "No, I am absolutely not rushing out the door so I can continue slipping into spinsterdom in peace." I feel like there should be a clear rule. If you're unmarried at my age and have been a bridesmaid more than 7 times, you should be automatically allowed an early exit from any couple's event without ever being deemed an asshole. With this decided, I inspect my vodka choices, pulling the most expensive one from an array of multicolored bottles.
"Is this the third wheel table?"
Because I'm mid-pour, I answer without turning around.
"The one with all the booze?" I ask. "It should be. I mean, it's the least they can do."
"Then I'm sorry, but I need to ask you to leave,"
the man says sternly. And just as I turn in surprise, I feel him lean in a little behind me to say more quietly,
"I was assured I was the only single person hired to work this event."
He's closer than I expected, and so my laugh is cut off when I see him. Is he kidding? He's single? No way am I this lucky. His hair is dark, longer on top, and as I watch him bend to inspect some of the bottles, he pushes it back from his forehead. Not like he's fixing it in any way. Quite the opposite, because now it's standing straight up, but like that's an unconscious thing he does. I immediately notice how comfortable he seems in his skin, loose and easygoing enough that it's a solid guess he wasn't just planning a bout of fake intestinal distress to make a dive for the nearest exit. He smiles again, and when I look down to what he's wearing, I have to close my eyes to stifle a laugh. "Did Steph put you up to this?" I ask.
"What?"
He follows my gaze. It's subtle, but with the hair, green eyes, and glasses, I can tell where he was going with the white shirt and loose tie beneath a gray zip-up jacket. Harry Potter. The lightning bolt scar drawn on his forehead helps. That probably should have immediately tipped me off. His brows furrow.
"Oh my God."
He takes in my robe, the tie, the wand, the wild dark hair I teased to within an inch of its life while I sat in traffic.
"Are you kidding me? The only 2 single people at this party and we match?"
I can't stifle the laugh this time, and it tears from me, surprising him as it does everyone who has ever heard it. I am small, but my laugh is mighty. He stares at me with a slow-growing, amused grin.
"Wow.
Hi." I hold out my hand. "I'm Evie."
"Is that short for evil?"
He pretends to be scared as he tentatively returns the handshake.
Are you sure you're Gryffindor? Your laugh makes me think you have a secret lab and are building an apocalyptic robot dog that's going to eat every smug person here. Slytherin, for sure.
It's short for Evelyn. The cackle is my gift. It keeps the delicate ones away.
I'm Carter.
He points two thumbs at his chest. Not delicate, I promise.
Is he flirting?
I consider the rolling tumbleweeds of my dating life and marvel that I can't even tell anymore. Carter is sort of dorky, despite being hot. The glasses look real, dark and thick-framed. He's taller than me, but not too tall, which is a bonus in my book, with eyes that are a startling green, hair deep brown and thick. I blink out of my inspection and back down to his face, realizing how long I've been staring at the top of his head.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
He points to his own costume again and smiles.
This was about the best I could do on half-assed motivation and an uninspired closet.
He looks me over again.
You're an amazing Hermione, though. Harry and Hermione, perfect. I ship it.
My stomach does another little tumble.
My friend Daryl was supposed to come along as my Ron, but she had to bail at the last minute. She's dead to me.
Carter's laugh comes out as a loud, surprised guffaw before he pops the tab on a can and takes a long, slow drink. Honestly, I'm trying to stay cool and not look too closely at him, but failing. Living in L.A., and especially working in Hollywood, I meet beautiful people every day, even dated a few. But in a town full of pretty faces, I've become immune to the predictability of them, the symmetry. Carter is pretty in a distinctive way. His eyes are big and lined with the darkest, thickest lashes. His jaw is sharp. With the thick frames of his glasses, his is an oblivious type of beauty. He needs a haircut. When he smiles, I see that his teeth are white, but not perfectly straight. It makes him seem immediately friendly, and his imperfections are surprising in a sea of Invisalign, Botox, and self-tanners. He looks real. Now, before you think I'm putting too much thought into this, let me remind you that I am no longer in my 20s, and when you meet men at my age, you immediately place them on one of three lists, just to make life easier for everyone. Dateable, not dateable, or gay. Dateable basically means you wear your bra when they're around and you don't talk about bodily functions or pimples. Not dateable or gay, anything goes.
You're ahead of me there. I never even had a plus one, he says. I was threatened into coming by our illustrious hosts. How do you know them?
I used to work with Steph at Alterman.
Something passes over Carter's face. A flicker of recognition, maybe? But before I can question it, Steph walks out juggling an armful of plates. Carter and I both struggle to make room for them amid the Red Bull.
What's up with the bar selection? I ask her, gesturing to the table. Are you expecting frat boys later? Oh my God, can you imagine?
Her question comes out breathy, nearly orgasmic, and I stare blankly at her.
Everything else is over there.
She lifts her chin, gesturing to another table in the living room that I now see is covered with wine, beer, and all the usual spirits. I slump my shoulders in mock defeat.
But that's in married territory.
We don't have tickets to that side of the room, Carter adds.
Steph looks like she's about to roll her eyes at us, but then she freezes and her mouth drops open.
You guys match!
Carter and I exchange a knowing look.
We talked earlier, he says. Made sure to coordinate it for maximum awkward.
She slaps his arm.
Shut up. Mikey and I knew the two of you would really hit it off. Did you know that we're all in talent management? I mean, guys, the two of you are like a match made in heaven, right?
Just before she heads back in the direction of the kitchen, Steph scrunches her nose at us as if we are a cute set of porcelain figures on a shelf, and she's tilted us just so toward each other. When Carter turns to me, we stare at each other for a wordless, stunned beat.
Those assholes set us up, he whispers.
It appears so. I glare back in Steph's direction. Don't they know that sort of thing never works?
It's like that movie with Seth Rogen and Katherine Heigl where they have that disastrous date.
He pauses with his can partway to his lips.
Or wait, am I remembering that wrong?
A sensation like pop rocks goes off in my chest. I know which movie he's talking about.
You mean Knocked Up?
He nods and I roll on.
It's not a date, actually. They meet at a club after she, Katherine Heigl, gets a promotion. She meets Seth Rogen at an actual club here in L.A. called Plan B, and they get drunk and have unprotected sex. She realizes she's pregnant 8 weeks later, and then they have the awkward date where she tells him.
When I finally come up for air, I see him watching me, eyebrows raised over the top of his Red Bull.
That was an impressive summary for a movie that came out over 10 years ago.
I give him a little shimmy.
It's my other gift.
His eyes shine.
I have to be honest. Stephanie should know better. You are incredibly pretty and obviously blessed with at least 2 enviable gifts. But sight unseen, nothing sounds worse than dating a fellow agent.
God, I agree. Dating someone in my business would be a disaster. The hours are terrible, the phone calls are constant, and the blood pressure and the sex life suffer.
So I'm glad he's said it. Glad he's just thrown it out there. It's like we're on the same team and suddenly there is zero pressure. Team, they're cute, but it could never work.
And, he adds, I just realized that you're the beloved Evelyn Abbey. It's all falling into place now.
I'm caught off guard for a second and not sure how to react. Hollywood is an industry of almost 40,000 people, but its circles are small. If he's heard of me and my track record, it could be great or not. I feel uneasy, not knowing which.
So you're an agent? I ask. How have we never met?
I'm in TV literary.
Small circles. I relax a little.
But Michael, Christopher, and Steph talk about you all the time.
You call Mike Michael Christopher? I ask. That's really cute. I'm getting Winnie the Pooh vibes.
We went to grade school together, Carter explains. And old habits die hard. He tries to pretend he's cool being married and having a 3-year-old kid who makes him wear tiaras, but deep down I know it makes him crazy that I'm still single and there are no pictures of me on Instagram wearing my kid's sparkly lip gloss.
I laugh.
Well, if it makes you feel better, this is going so much better than the last time Steph tried to set me up.
Carter has the magical ability to sharply lift one eyebrow, and it makes a chemical reaction in me go off like a bomb.
She does this to you a lot?
Last time, I explain. She set me up with her chubby 22-year-old cousin, Wyatt.
That's thoughtful. She must really like Wyatt.
I let this compliment slide warmly over me.
I'm 33, so...
Carter's laugh is soft, but his entire face smiles when he does it.
He couldn't handle you, I take it.
Newly graduated from UCLA, poor Wyatt hadn't been out on a date in a few months.
I smile.
Or ever.
I'm unsure what to do with the straightforward honesty of his attention as he listens. I'm used to being the person who dissolves into the background by necessity. Most of my life, most of my socializing, is centered around work. And there, I make myself seen when I need to raise the red flag or go to bat for my clients. But otherwise, my job is best done from backstage. It's only when I'm here, standing with a man who is watching me like I'm the only thing in the room, that I realize how long it's been since anyone has looked at me this way. A thought occurs to me. Although he grew up with Mike back east, if Carter's in TV lit, he's probably local. Daryl might even know him.
Where do you work?
Carter smiles as if he realizes that what he's about to say is a tiny social stink bomb dropped between us.
CTM.
CT Management is our biggest rival. Inside of me, there are warring impulses, an urge to fist pump because he's local, offset by an instinctive spike of competitiveness. If he notices my silence, he rolls past it,
I moved out here 2 years ago. And I'm saying this as someone who grew up surrounded by subways and a million other ways to get where you need to be, he says. But here? God. I live in Beverly Hills. Never thought I'd say that. And it's still a nightmare getting anywhere.
You East Coasters are so spoiled with your, I make finger quotes, subways and efficient taxi system. Carter's laugh is a quiet, whiskery chuckle.
It's true. I'm a Long Island boy at heart. But now I'm going Hollywood.
Just make sure you don't go full on Hollywood.
I'm not even sure I know what it means to go full on Hollywood. Is that when you look at the $500 shoes at Saks and think, I should probably get those, because we had that in Manhattan.
Worse, I say. It's when you recognize the $500 shoes on someone else's feet and know where they probably bought them, and then you judge the person wearing them a little because those loafers are no longer the town's number one underappreciated overpriced designer, and you know they were on sale last week, so they didn't pay full price.
Wow. You are evil.
Oh, that's not me. I hold up my hands and then point to my simple yellow flats peeking out beneath my robe. I'll have you know, these shoes are from Old Navy, sir. Purchased on clearance, but I've lived here my entire life. Every day it's a struggle to not get pulled down into the game.
The game?
Talent agents in Hollywood, I say. You know it's a game.
Right, right.
He nods, and I realize with that one subtle gesture, he's already playing. And if my instinct is right, he's good at it, too. He's wide open until the subject of work comes up, and then a filter slides into place. Interesting. I take a sip of my drink, looking out at the party around us. Together, Carter and I form this tiny island in the dining room. It's almost as if the rest of the guests have been instructed to leave us alone.
So you're at P&D, he says.
I am. I look at him, trying to read him like I do every new person I meet, so I can figure out how to best interact, and I think he's unflappable. Under Brad Kingman. Carter doesn't react, and if my guess is correct, it's because he already knew this about me.
Is it true he's notoriously picky about food and only eats raw, unprocessed, no sugar?
Carter grins as he cheekily tilts his can of Red Bull to his lips.
Obviously, I am very health conscious myself.
I laugh. It's true. All of it.
It can't be as extreme as everyone says.
One time, I begin. I put a Home and Garden magazine on his desk, thinking he could take the dog food bar sample stuck to the cover home to his pampered Great Dane. I walked by later and he was eating it. Like, he's so used to bland, tasteless food that he ate an organic dog food bar and didn't realize it wasn't for people. Carter looks horrified.
Did you say anything?
No, I say, unable to keep from laughing. But in my own defense, he'd just told me I looked a little fluffy in my new dress, so maybe he deserved it. As soon as the last word is out of my mouth, I wish I could take it back. Agents are notoriously gossipy. In some ways, sharing confidences to make inroads is part of the business, but it's never been a very large part of my business. I keep it level. I keep it up front. I get things done. And as much as I felt justified letting my boss eat dog food, I don't get bogged down in sharing stories of bad behavior, drunken antics on tabletops at bars, or which intern is banging which partner. Unless I'm with Daryl or Amelia, in which case the gloves come off. And in general, I like to run in like-minded circles. Reputation is everything. Carter leans in.
That's a pretty terrible thing to say to you, though.
And damn it, by whispering this reassurance, he's managed to play both the professional and the reassuring angle. Good agents can read people. Instinctively put them at ease and get them talking, or remain discreet in every situation. Great agents can seamlessly do all three. We all tend to keep our cards pretty close to our chests and not let on what we're really thinking. Our guards are up
Our walls are high, and our bullshit meters are tuned to the most sensitive setting possible. It occurs to me, looking at him a little more closely, that Carter definitely keeps his cards close to his chest. Yeah. But he also seems to have a really good hand.
Chapter 2. Carter. Michael Christopher finds me Saturday morning, paper open on the table, coffee maker sputtering quietly in the background.
Glad you didn't try to drive home.
His voice is broken glass scratchy, and when I look up, I grin at the sight of him in a blue velvet bathrobe hanging haphazardly open over a folded t-shirt and a pair of striped boxers. Atop his head, his hair reaches a campfire peak. Morning, Mr. Hefner. He swears roundly when his foot locates a handful of Legos buried in the fluffy kitchen rug. Language. I've heard Stephanie give him this understated reminder at least a dozen times. Michael growls, bending to inspect the damage.
You don't know pain till you've had one of these fuckers embedded into the arch of your foot.
Satisfied he isn't bleeding, he hobbles the rest of the way to the cupboard, pulls down a white ceramic coffee mug with Morgan's tiny handprint stamped on the side, and pours himself some coffee.
Why are you always up so early?
I don't know. My internal clock refuses to give up being a New Yorker.
Your internal clock is an idiot.
I know, I laugh. Nice robe, by the way. He pours the cream into his mug and slips the carton back into the refrigerator. The fridge in the apartment we shared in college was covered in pizza coupons and phone numbers. This one has a giant drawing of Big Bird and reminders about playdates. Michael drops into the seat across from me and takes a sip of his coffee.
It was a gift from Steph for Father's Day.
Well, congratulations. You're officially your dad. Leaning over the table, Michael inhales the steam rising from his coffee.
I can't do smartass yet, Carter. My head is killing me, and I'm still trying to figure out why I was wearing Steph's underwear when I woke up.
Nope. No. No. I shake my head, trying to dislodge this particular mental image before it burns itself into my brain. Standing, I head for the ibuprofen I know is kept in the cupboard next to the sink. The medicine cabinet, they call it. It's filled with prescriptions and band-aids and every over-the-counter medication you could ever need. There's a bottle of iodine in there, for God's sake. Adults have iodine. My mom has iodine. I'm 28 years old and couldn't tell you with absolute certainty what a bottle of iodine is even for. It's at these moments that I see the stark contrast between our lives. Michael and Steph have a 3-bedroom house on a quiet residential street. They have a mailbox with Evans whimsically hand-painted across the side and a growth chart on the back of a closet door. They have a kid. I have a small 1-bedroom apartment and a cactus I'm proud to have kept alive for 6 months. When did he move past me on the adult achievement scale? Maybe it was getting married or braving the real estate adventure that did it, or maybe it was becoming a dad. Either way, I could never ask, because as responsible as he and Steph have become, they both still consider themselves barely out of adolescence, and any mention to the contrary would lead to their insisting we crash a kegger or find the nearest rave. And I, ironically, am definitely too old for that. With 3 brown Advil and a glass of water in hand, I return to the table and set it all in front of him. He mumbles his thanks and takes both the drugs and the glass, draining the water in one long drink.
I am rough this morning.
How are you surprised? I sit back down. You had Red Bull and 3 different types of marijuana products at your party. I haven't seen booze and weed in the same place since senior year. He looks up mildly offended.
It was a great party.
It was, but it was also a costume party in late September.
Halloween is a busy time for Morgan, he explains. There are play dates and costume parades and fall carnivals to contend with. That kid is busier than I am. Steph and I had to move our party up.
I go quiet, hoping the echo of his words sinks in a bit, but he still seems to be falling in love with his coffee. Finally, I break. I think the female wearing the most actual clothing was your wife dressed as Miley Cyrus. Michael Christopher gets a tiny glint in his eye.
I don't know about that. Evie seemed to be showing about as much skin as you were, you adorable Hogwartsers, you.
Here we go. I bend, taking another sip of my coffee. In my peripheral vision, I see him try to pull off a casual shrug.
Steph thought you guys might hit it off.
I'm taking at least 5 of your remaining cool points for letting your wife set me up with someone.
You didn't seem to mind last night.
I set down my cup and do my best to ignore the small surge in my pulse. It's true that I had more chemistry with Evie in the 3 hours we were together than I'd had with all my dates in the past year combined. I didn't mind, really, I tell him. She's hot, she's funny, and that laugh, amazing. He pauses, and I feel him lean in a little across the table.
I'm about to do that thing where I get excited at the prospect of you hooking up with someone we know and us hanging out together as couples. I need a cool couple to hang out with, Carter. Everyone here wants to talk about how going gluten-free has changed their life, or how much they've put into their particular SEP-IRA.
Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. I like her enough, but come on. I lean my elbows on the table. You live with Steph. You see the hours she works. Imagine Steph dating Steph. No way. It'd be a nightmare and we'd end up hating each other.
Why does logic always have to crush all my dreams?
He takes a moment to look behind him to the open doorway before quietly adding,
Never tell my wife I suggested this, but you could just hook up, have a little fun, see where it goes.
I don't know if that's a good idea. We traded numbers, at least. I stand to put my cup in the sink. She was fun to talk to, and the connection might come in handy at some point if I can move into features.
That could still work out for me if one of you got fired, he says with a grin.
Not exactly where I was going with that, but I like your twisted brand of optimism. We look up at the same time at the sound of bass thumping and a car driving too fast down the quiet, sleeping street. Michael stands and stares out the window overlooking the driveway.
Didn't you tell me Jonah drives a black Range Rover?
Jonah? As in my brother, Jonah? I ask, moving to join him. Sure enough, we watch as a shiny black Range Rover makes a skidding turn into Michael Christopher's narrow driveway. The engine abruptly cuts off, and the sudden silence makes my ears ring. I'm already dreading this confrontation. I haven't seen or spoken to my younger brother in months. I have no idea what he's doing here now. We watch as the driver's side door opens and a pair of denim-clad legs emerge.
Well, he looks different, Michael says, brows raised.
You haven't seen him since he was 18. Of course he looks different. I push off the counter and head toward the front door. In fact, most people we grew up with haven't seen Jonah since he left home right after graduation. He was the artsy kid, the one with the camera around his neck who took photos of power lines and brick walls and depressing candid shots of people who seemed incapable of smiling. It was one of these photos that won him a scholarship to some elite arts academy senior year, but while everyone else was making plans for college, Jonah took his camera and a duffel bag and moved to L.A. Just like that. Once here, he got the right guy high at a party and was hired on the spot for a black-and-white candid shoot of one of rock and roll's biggest guitar legends. The musician died tragically only days later, and overnight, Jonah went from starving artist to the cover photographer for a record-selling issue of Rolling Stone and the It Boy, with more jobs and women and money than he knew what to do with. My mom never stops talking about him. It's strange to be the older brother and still feel like the one who's so far behind.
I'm talking about the tattoos and the earrings, Michael is saying, following me down the hall. He looks like the purposefully cool guy from a boy band.
I fling open the front door just as Jonah begins stomping up the front steps.
Do you have any idea what time it is?
I whisper yell, stepping out onto the porch and inwardly cringing because I sound exactly like our mother. Jonah drops a cigarette onto Michael's porch, stubs it out with the pointy toe of a boot, and then has the nerve to seem confused.
Huh?
Steph and Morgan are in bed, I explain slowly. It's Saturday morning in a quiet neighborhood. I take in his jeans and t-shirt, the black leather jacket and day's worth of stubble.
Most people are still in bed and you come tearing down the street like you've got your own personal house party going on in that thing.
Okay, Dad.
He shoulders past me into the house, giving Michael Christopher the once-over before laughing, a little unkindly.
So this is what married with kids looks like? Rugged.
Michael opens his mouth to reply before the insult seems to register, and he gives Jonah a what-the-fuck face.
Unfortunately, Jonah misses it because he's already moving past him toward the kitchen.
Nice place.
I follow my brother and watch as he pours himself a cup of coffee.
Help yourself, Jones.
He turns, leaning back against the counter and lifting his cup to his lips.
Mom sent me about 200 texts asking if I knew where you were.
He sips, swallowing loudly.
Guess she doesn't know we've only seen each other once since you moved here.
You've been home one time in 4 years, I remind him, so spare me the family bonding lecture.
Yes, I'm busy, but I'd make time for my family. Thank God Mom sent me this address, or who knows how long before I found out you're basically homeless and sleeping on your college roommate's couch.
Actually, we have a guest room, Michael Christopher offers unhelpfully.
I'm not homeless, dumbass, I tell Jonah. I just crashed here last night.
Michael claps us both on the shoulders with an awkward laugh.
Moving on. How's work, Jones? I saw that blurb about you and people last year.
Fucking people. Amazing, man.
My brother pulls out a chair, turns it around, and straddles it like an asshole.
It was okay, he says. Now Vogue, that was badass.
I study him for a few seconds.
Jones, you look like you haven't showered in a week.
He grins over the top of his mug.
Fucking crazy night.
Michael Christopher spins his own chair around and straddles it just like Jonah.
We had a pretty crazy night ourselves, didn't we, Carter?
It was pretty crazy,
I agree, heavy on the sarcasm. They might have had Red Bull and pot, but there was also a sangria bar, a tampon bouquet in the bathroom, and a pumping room cordoned off for nursing mothers.
Yeah, this place was off the hook, Michael says, undeterred. Went pretty late, too. Well, I mean, it was over by 11 because Morgan gets cranky if she doesn't get enough sleep, and a lot of people here had sitters they had to get home to. But until then, insane.
Jonah nods like he can relate, and to his credit, he doesn't give Michael a hard time.
Carter even hit it off with someone,
Michael says. I groan as soon as the words are out of his mouth.
A girl?
Jonah grins. I scowl at him.
A woman, yeah.
Jonah laughs into his coffee.
Sorry, he said. I mean, woman.
I give Michael a look that I hope is terrifying.
What's her name, MC?
Jonah asks. Do I know her?
No,
I interject. Who knows if I'm right, but it's a desperate wish tossed out to the universe.
Evie, MC says eagerly. She's hot, smart, great body. She used to work with Steph over at Alter.
I cut him off. Michael. Zip it. Jonah claps his hands together and I startle.
Man, Mama's gonna love this.
Don't talk to Mom about my dating life, and I won't mention to her the rotating buffet of barely legals in your bed. He counters my low blow with an even lower one.
You're right. I wouldn't want to get her hopes up. You remember how hard she took it when you screwed things up with Gwen.
I think I hear Michael Christopher wince from across the room.
Oh, my God.
I groan, cupping my forehead. Gwen Talbot was the first girl I fell in love with, and my mom adored her. Where most mothers might try to convince their 24-year-old son he was too young to get serious, let alone engaged, I could practically see Mom naming her grandchildren whenever I brought Gwen home. But Gwen and I were never on the same page. She wanted a quiet life in Long Island, with a house and kids. I was working for an agent and living in a crappy apartment in the city so I could go to every show and meet every influential person in theater. The pay was terrible, and the hours were even worse, and we ended our engagement after a year. I don't think Mom has recovered. Jonah loves to push this particular bruise and looks pleased as he sits there and continues to drink his coffee. I work on remembering why it'd be a bad idea to punch him in the throat. Jonah, with his Range Rover and money and dragon tattoos, Jonah is an asshole.
Gwen was a whore, MC finally says, breaking the loaded silence. And I don't mean that in a loose-with-her-sexual-morals sort of way, because I totally approve of that, and girls should be able to have sex with whomever they want and not be judged. Just the way she acted when you guys ended things? What a dick.
I nod in thanks to Michael, because, yeah, Gwen was a dick. And I turn back to my brother. Just keep your mouth closed. Seriously, why are you here?
Mom called a bunch of times and said you weren't answering your phone.
Then she said to check in with MC, because if you were dead in a ditch somewhere, he'd probably know where.
Wait, what? MC says, looking insulted.
Jonah drains his mug and stands, letting his chair slide noisily against the floor. He leaves both the cup and the chair where they are.
And since you're not, I can go. Later, big brother.
And like that, he's gone. As if she's been camped in the hall plotting an ambush, my assistant sees me the minute I step out of the elevator on Monday morning.
You're here, she chirps.
Becca, what are you doing? It's barely 8 a.m.
Undeterred, she starts toward my office, notebook in hand, and unless I plan on turning back into the elevator, which isn't the worst idea I've ever had, there's really no choice but to follow.
I wanted to make sure I caught you before anyone else did, she says over her shoulder. One of Blake's clients has been asking about you.
Who?
Pretty one with biceps.
Becca rarely calls anyone by their given name. In TV literary, we represent an assortment of writers and creators, but very few actors. Most of those land in features.
Emile Shepard is one of ours, however, and it takes a moment for me to process what she said. If Emile wants to move from Blake's client list to mine, that would make him the third in the last 2 months alone, and my first big actor.
Understatement? Blake isn't going to be happy about this.
Emile was asking about me?
He called 3 times over the weekend, she says, tugging on my arm to get me moving again.
Does Blake know?
Becca tears off a piece of paper covered in lines of almost indecipherable cursive and hands it to me.
I haven't heard any tables being flipped, so I'm assuming the answer is no. You need to call Emile this morning if you're interested before anyone else catches wind of it. You know what a nightmare that kind of thing can be. And if Emile's moving, he's moving. You're not poaching.
Her reassurance is nice, but it's still a messy situation. I want to eventually move into features, but taking talent from colleagues isn't the ideal way to get there. I can't even think about what this could mean.
Becca rattles off my schedule. Meetings at 9 and 9:30, another at 10 over Skype, a staff meeting immediately after, and a possible new author over lunch.
I'd always thought that if I had a type, Becca would be it. She's smart and sarcastic, with red hair and blue eyes and a body that's on the curvy side.
We met by chance in a coffee shop one day right after I moved here, and I'd liked her immediately. In fact, I'd liked her so much I was about to ask her out when she exclaimed she was about to be late for a job interview. That interview, it turned out, was with me. I'm thankful every day that she glanced down at her watch before I asked her to dinner. But despite our less than conventional beginning, things have never been weird between the two of us, or anything other than professional. Becca is amazing at her job, and in reality knows more about what goes on here than any of the partners do, which also means she'd make a fantastic agent in her own right. She swears she doesn't have the particular muscle for it, though. We've reached my office by the time she gets to the bottom of her very long list.
Carter, she asks, noting that my attention is strayed to a spot in the distance.
Did you get all that?
I glance back down and scan the paper in my hand, pointedly not looking at the pile of mail and various "call me when you're in" post-its stuck to my computer monitor.
Most of it, I think, I tell her. But it's possible I haven't had enough caffeine and I'm not functioning on all 4 cylinders yet. Give me an hour and check in again.
I don't know what you did to deserve me, she says, stepping around my desk and lifting a steaming paper cup from just beside my keyboard.
You are a goddess. The smell alone sets off some Pavlovian response, and I already feel more alert.
I didn't leave myself enough time to grab another on my way in. I'm buying you lunch today.
She points to the 12 o'clock on my paper.
No, you'll be buying Alan Porter lunch. Possible new client, remember?
My posture slumps.
Right.
She grips me by the shoulders and leads me to my desk.
Today is packed, but you might as well get it over with.
I drop into my chair and watch as she walks to the window and yanks open the blinds.
Happy Monday.
Chapter 3. Evie.
Evie, I need to see you for a minute.
I look up to see Brad's shadow already disappearing from my doorway. Sure thing, I say to my empty office, pushing back from my desk. The sounds of phones and the clicking of keys greet me as I walk down the gray, carpeted hall.
The layout is long and narrow, with smaller individual offices bordering the exterior walls and larger offices or executives on each end. The assistants don't sit outside their particular agent's office, where it would be convenient to grab them should the need arise. No, they, along with the interns, sit in an inner ring of long tables, creating a shared workspace. That way everything feels like a team effort rather than individuals cast adrift without support. That's how Brad feels about the arrangement, at least. To everyone who actually has to work, it's a giant pain in the ass. My relationship with Brad Kingman has always been delicate. For starters, though he didn't know me at the time, Brad was an agent at my first real post-college job almost 10 years ago. He wasn't always the nicest guy and had a reputation for some shady practices, including client poaching. Not illegal, but definitely not encouraged either. He would keep track of actors just coming off of failure and quietly suggest to them that their agent should shoulder some of the blame, that more should have been done to protect the actor. He would find a client he was interested in representing and stop by a shoot while they were on set, explaining that he was there visiting another client and then acting surprised to hear that their agent had never been on set before. Brad was a master of planting seeds that in the end did most of the dirty work for him. He did this repeatedly on the set of a movie called Uprising and, funnily enough, ended up signing the lead actor a mere 2 months after shooting wrapped. Only 1 month after that, he was put in charge of features at P&D. While that's not how I do business, and I would never admit this to anyone, I did learn a few tricks from him. The most important of which is, don't forget for even 1 second that the moment you leave your house and step out in Hollywood, people are paying attention. Brad only learned we had worked at the same agency years later, after I'd been hired at P&D. And I'm sure it's because he knows I would have heard a few inside stories or learned a little too much about how he does things that he keeps me close. Not as a confidant or friend, but close enough to hold under his thumb. "Go on in," his assistant Kylie tells me. Kylie seems smart and reasonably good at her job. Plus, she puts up with Brad all day, every day. Her bullshit tolerance must be off the chart. Brad Kingman looks a little like the miracle baby produced by Hugh Jackman and Christopher Walken. Good skin, stark blue eyes, and severe bone structure. Sitting here in this office, surrounded by awards and celebrity photos and framed by a sweeping view of the Hollywood Hills, he's the portrait of success. He reaches for a paperclip and his custom-tailored shirt stretches across the type of chest and arms you can only get from a lot of time at the gym. A green smoothie sits on the corner of his desk, and despite my annoyance at being here, I inwardly smile. That kale sludge is his version of junk food. No wonder he didn't notice the dog food bar.
"Have a seat,"
he says, and I do, waiting while he takes the next few minutes to finish scribbling something in a black ledger before securing the entire booklet with a thick leather band. Not like he couldn't have done that before he called me in.
"Listen, kiddo, I need you to throw in a team token."
I remind myself to count to three before I answer. Team token is one of my least favorite Bradisms. It's his stupid catchphrase for a favor, but if he makes it about being a team player, there's no way to pass without looking like the bad guy. "For what?" I keep my expression neutral.
"I want you to give John a little help building his list back up."
I look up, confused. John Feinman is a very well-established colleague in features. "Brad, he's been here longer than I have."
"I'm aware."
Brad leans back in his chair.
"But we all know he's lost 2 heavy hitters this year. Now he's in the middle of a divorce and a little distracted. Maybe throw him a pass once in a while."